On this episode of Skeptico, well-known skeptic and consciousness researcher Dr. Sue Blackmore makes the case for scientific skepticism.
We live in a pointless universe. We're here for no reason at all. There isn't a soul. There isn't a spirit. We're not going to live forever in some kind of heaven or something like that. And I think there are no paranormal phenomena, although I can't be sure about that, but I really think there aren't. Yet, we have extraordinary experiences.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico. We're joined today by Dr. Sue Blackmore. As a freelance writer, lecturer, and broadcaster in the UK, Dr. Blackmore has written many fine books on consciousness, the latest being Conversations on Consciousness, What the Best Minds Think About the Brain, Free Will, and What It Means to Be Human. By the way, she has a very nice and extensive website at susanblackmore.co.uk. We'll have a link to that on the Skeptico website. So if there's anything you find particularly interesting that you want to follow up on, there's a way to do that. Dr. Blackmore has a degree in psychology from Oxford University and went on to receive a PhD in parapsychology. And that's where the story gets particularly interesting, because after years of research in the field of parapsychology, she determined, well, I guess you could say that there is no there there. Is that basically right, Dr. Blackmore?
That's basically right, yes. A sad story of having to change my mind and find out I was wrong, but that's how it goes.
Great. And what were the main factors that kind of drove you to that reversing your position?
Well, I think you have to understand first how very strong my position was. When I was first a student in Oxford, I joined the Psychical Research Society. In fact, I ran the society most of the time I was there. I got very involved with psychic things. We had witches and druids and psychics and mediums, you know, coming to give lectures. We did all sorts of things ourselves. We did lots of Ouija board sessions and went to haunted houses and all kinds of stuff. And I had a very dramatic out-of-the-body experience, which lasted about 2.5 hours, and really had, at the beginning, all the features of a classic out-of-the-body experience with, floating above my body, the core, the tunnel, the light, the whole works, and went on to become something, I would say, of a mystical experience. So from all those experiences, I felt that my lecturers were wrong, that what I was learning at Oxford University in psychology and physiology was just too narrow, and that none of it could explain all these amazing things. And so I, you know, in my naivety as a young sort of hippie student with my flowing beads and, you know, whatever, decided that I wanted to become a parapsychologist and prove all these closed-minded scientists wrong. So you can, you know, imagine me then dressing in my hippie clothes, taking interesting drugs, having a far out wild time, and intellectually really excited about all this, and thinking, hey, you know, I'm going to discover the truth behind telepathy, etc. And finally got myself a place to do a PhD and working on experiments on telepathy and clairvoyance and precognition. And I jumped in with this theory I had about how they worked, and again and again I got chance results. So I'd have, you know, I'd invent another experiment, and again I'd get chance results. And then I'd do an experiment that seemed to work, and I've got a significant result. And then I'd find that I'd done the statistics wrong, or I hadn't controlled something in the experiment. And the harder I worked, the more it became obvious that I was only going to get chance results. And I had to think one day, well, I had to keep thinking, you know, well, surely it must be somewhere. But as time went by, I was like banging my head against a brick wall. I kept trying, and I never found any phenomena.
And that's interesting, and I think that's what led you to, I think, your current position. You are well known as and called upon as somewhat of a debunker or a skeptic of psychic phenomena and paranormal phenomena. I recently was going through some interviews that you did on the BBC, and I ran across a quote. So here we are, for no good reason at all, for no purpose, in a pointless universe, and we just have to get on with it. Does that sum up, I guess, the end of your journey and where you've come in terms of looking at paranormal research as being a possible avenue for explaining a transcendent soul or that aspect of consciousness?
Absolutely. That I forgot I'd written that. That absolutely sums up what I think about the universe and about our own spiritual endeavor. I think if we're going to have a spiritual path, work at it, it's got to be in the context of what we know about the universe. And I would say, yes, we live in a pointless universe. We're here for no reason at all. There isn't a soul. There isn't a spirit. We're not going to live forever in some kind of heaven or something like that. And I think there are no paranormal phenomena, although I can't be sure about that, but I really think there aren't. Yet, we have extraordinary experiences. You know, I have had out-of-the-body experiences. I have had all the aspects of a near-death experience at different times. I've had mystical experiences of various kinds. There is no question that human beings are capable of extraordinary states of mind and insight into the nature of self and the universe. So it seems to me we can have a spiritual life, if you mean by that a spiritual life without spirit, you know, without something that goes somewhere else, without an extra self. But it has to be one that recognizes what we know, that brains are what do the trick, that we are biological entities and that we evolved. That's how we got here. So that's what I'm trying to do, which is completely different from what I set out to do in the beginning.
You know, one of the things we like to do, and it's worked kind of well in the past, is play some audio clips from some other experts, scholars, and get your response, your point of view. So I have a couple of clips. The first one is from Dr. Charles Tart, a well-known psychologist, consciousness researcher, who is considered by most to be the father of transpersonal psychology.
I know Charlie very well.
Great. Let me play this quote, or this audio clip rather, and get a response that you might have.
It's clear to me that we human beings have a need for meaning. And if we don't have a meaning structure in our life, then we get sick and we start doing crazy things as we try to distract ourselves. Take the meaning away is a terrible thing. Well, we live in a time when materialistic scientism, that is, taking a philosophy of materialism and pretending it's scientifically absolutely true, is dominant in higher intellectual circles all the time. But on the other hand, people think that that's the scientific truth, right? Science has proven there's no such thing as a soul or a mind. You know, it's all just chemical and electrical action within the brain. I find parapsychology really important because of its implications of giving support to a more spiritual view. Not as something you're going to believe because you want to, because you're so desperate for meaning you'll believe anything, even if it's nonsensical, but because using the best kind of scientific method, the most rigorous kind of scientific method, we constantly find evidence that the human mind can do things that sound like what we mean for spiritual things.
Okay, Dr. Blackmore, what would be a response that you might have to that?
Well, he's right that we need meaning, but we should not just go for meaning, you know, because it makes us happy. As a scientist, I always prefer truth to comfort. I really want to find out how the world is, not how I would like it to be. Now, almost everybody throughout history and prehistory has wanted there to be a self or a soul and for it to survive. That's the common starting point in every culture. And it's very, very hard to overthrow that. That's what science does. Now, I disagree deeply with Charlie about the evidence, and he knows this, and we've argued about it endlessly. The evidence for paranormal phenomena is not good at all. It's dreadful, in fact. What is there, and both Charlie and I have done a lot of investigations of this, are extraordinary experiences, out-of-the-body experiences, experiences of oneness with the universe, experiences in which the self seems to go away. Now, it seems to me that in those experiences are some true insights. For example, the classic experience of oneness, which can come through meditation, it can come through drugs, it can come through sudden insight, is actually true. You know, there is only one stuff in the universe. There isn't a separate soul and a spirit and all that. There's just this stuff. I don't know whether to call it matter or mind or whatever, but dualism doesn't work. There's only one kind of stuff. And we, as physical bodies, are part of that stuff. So far from saying that a mystical experience of oneness should lead us into thinking of transcendental things and spirits and souls, no, it should lead us into, wow, what is this? Is this compatible with what we know in science? Yes, it is. perhaps actually mystics are really seeing clearly. Let's work on that rather than trying to overthrow the best science we've got. Let's stick with the best science we've got, stick with the best spiritual experiences we've got, and see where we go from there. That's what I would rather do.
But isn't there a counter argument to be made that kind of is almost the exact polar opposite of that, that the reductionist materialistic paradigm that science, and I hate to use that word like that, because as we know, science is a method, not a position.
Yeah.
But let's go ahead and stick with it, because it's what we have. But isn't that paradigm, maybe it doesn't really fit the dead? I mean, if we dig into that a little bit, and this ties right into your research, so let's see what you have to say. The near-death experience, if I take the other side of that, I say, okay, there's an enormous amount of natural history across time, across cultures, reported over and over again. And then we have case history from people who are trained to observe these things, cardiologists, neurologists, who report amazing, we can't call them anecdotal stories, we really have to call them case studies. I mean, these are people who are trained to observe these things. And then we have how the experience actually affects people. It's a transcendent experience, a transformative experience. I mean, don't these together cause us to really change the paradigm and say, okay, we really have to dig in and find out how we can dig up the data to support this, rather than the existing paradigm, which is, how do we immediately have to reduce these experiences and dismiss these experiences and find a way to explain them away rather than to explain them?
No. You're falling for, I get so frustrated because you're falling for the polarization that the media will always put on this, which is between either these experiences really happen and they really affect people and they're really amazing and therefore they're true and therefore there's life after death and a spirit and a soul, blah, blah, blah. Or they're really uninteresting, we shouldn't be bothering with them, we should reduce them and explain them away. Both those are faulty and I wouldn't want to go down either of those paths. The first one doesn't have the evidence to back it up and it doesn't have a theoretical basis that makes any sense. The second is just bad science. It's what Dan Dennett would call greedy reductionism. It's just trying to reduce something away instead of actually addressing it scientifically. So let's address near-death experiences properly and scientifically. Right, what do we know? We know a lot of the things you said. We know they've happened in all the cultures we've studied. They happen again and again. They happen to people close to death and at other times. They have common features, the tunnel, the light at the end, the life review, the decision to return, other beings, feelings of warmth and joy and acceptance, sometimes the judgment, self-judgment. All of these things we know extensively. I know them personally because I've had these experiences. I know what they feel like. And that comes into it too. As a good scientist, we want to bring everything that we can to bear on it. So what do we do then? Well, let's look at the evidence. The evidence in near-death experiences is that anybody actually sees anything at a distance that they shouldn't see is lousy. I know you'll tell me about tennis shoes. There was only one person and no other witness to that tennis shoe on the ledge in Seattle. I know you might tell me the famous Wilmot case, someone traveling across the Atlantic. That was a story told by only one person. I know you can tell me stories of people who are blind and see again. But even Ken Ring, who is the greatest expert on this, will say, yes, but maybe it wasn't exactly seeing. And we know that people who are blind imagine the world. They have good spatial sense through other senses. So in my mind, and honestly, I researched these things for a long, long time, there is no good, sound evidence that anything leaves the body during near-death experiences. So what's going on? Well, here are profound experiences that dramatically change people's view of themselves and the world. Now, I think one of the things that's going on, but probably only in the deepest of near-death experiences, is that this ordinary, constructed and false sense of self, in other words, that I am a separate little entity, a spirit or a soul or something like that, and that I'm really important, that breaks down because the brain is no longer able to construct such a false sense of self. And once having broken down, then if that person has ever managed to experience the world without seeing through the eyes of a false self, then they are just a little bit loosened up to being more open and at one with the universe. Now, it takes many people, 20 years of meditation to get to selfless states, but you can get zapped there by a near-death experience. And I think that, at its deepest, is what the near-death experience does. It's a deep spiritual transformation. Nothing to do with other worlds, nothing to do with life after death, nothing to do with religion, but some natural capacity of the human brain. at their less dramatic near-death experiences, lead people into all sorts of religious conclusions. But I think those are false conclusions, and we should press on with the science to understand what's really happening here and why people are transformed by them.
Okay, great. Very interesting. So let's just move on to another topic, because this is exactly the kind of dialogue that I was hoping to create. And as you can imagine, we're going to take some of these clips and play them back to some other folks and try and get a real genuine dialogue going on.
Before you go on, your last question was so long, I was going to answer the first part of it, but then I got carried away about NDEs. But perhaps I could answer the first bit. You can chuck this bit away if you want to. I think you're making a mistake there when you characterize the paradigm as materialist, reductionist, and scientist. I mean, to be scientism means that you're taking science too seriously, and good scientists will always have an open mind about things. Secondly, reductionism, there's good and bad reductionism. Reductionism is a very powerful tool in science, but if you push it too far, then you just throw away what you're looking for, and it's no good. So any good scientist will be very cautious with just how far the reduction goes. And finally, materialism, well, I think there are very, very good reasons for being a monist rather than a dualist. Dualism just doesn't work. It has horrendous problems. But if you throw out dualism and you say, well, there's just one kind of stuff in the universe, what is that stuff? Personally, I'm not a materialist. I'm a monist. I don't believe in separate souls and spirits or gods or the mind being separate from the body. So I'm a monist, but I just don't know how to characterize the stuff of the universe. I spend a lot of time meditating and staring into it and thinking, what is this? All of this can fit within the current scientific paradigm. You don't have to be a bad, greedy, reductionist, materialist to be a scientist today.
Very good. Well said. And I take it you're a much better meditator than I am. I've spent 20 years on the yoga mat just to get away from sitting on the block and meditating. So, I admire that discipline, certainly. But let's talk for a minute about reincarnation. Okay, again, undoubtedly, there's that huge natural history. And there's also some solid, carefully done research by people like Ian Stevenson. I'm sure you're aware of this, and you'd have plenty of thoughts. And I'd just like to get them on the whole subject of reincarnation and whether we've come anywhere close to establishing good, solid evidence for that.
I don't think that reincarnation makes sense at all. To believe in reincarnation in its traditional sense of something being reincarnated from one body to the next, from one life to the next, you've got to believe in the idea that in all of us is a separate self or a soul or a spirit or something that could be reincarnated. Now, the more we learn all about the brain and how it works and so on, the less likely it seems that there is such a self. And from that point of view alone, I would say reincarnation is unlikely. What interests me is to look at it from a Buddhist perspective. I know quite a lot about Zen. I've been training in Zen for more than 20 years, 25 years probably. And I think I rather like that end of Buddhism where things are very clear and very stark, and the understanding there of reincarnation is not at all a personal kind of reincarnation. Indeed, it can't be, because the heart of what the Buddha saw sitting under the Bodhi tree was that suffering comes about through clinging to a false sense of a self, wanting things for myself, wanting nice things, rejecting bad things for myself. He saw that there is no such permanent self in any of us. We're all just stuff happening after stuff happening after stuff happening. Now, if you take that seriously, there cannot be reincarnation in the popular sense of somebody being passed on from life to life. So what does it mean then within a Buddhist framework? Something rather subtle, I think. Something like this, that in every moment we're born again, there is no continuous self at all. Oh gosh, here am I sitting here talking on the phone, and I think that was the same me as a minute ago, but actually it's all just stuff happening. There isn't a continuous self. So when I die, it won't be any different, because there isn't really anybody to die. So dying will be no different from going on living. I think it's something like that. But in any case, my enthusiasm, it's not that I think I have the right answers, it's but my enthusiasm is to say that let's not stick with the boring old traditional views, which, you know, that what everybody wants, the spirit and the soul, and that, you know, there's going to be some justification in the future life for what I've done. Let's really try and take together what we know from science and what we can learn by disciplined practice of looking through personal practice, and see whether we can't have a better understanding of what might be meant. As for traditional reincarnation, no way. You asked about the evidence from Ian Stevenson. I haven't followed the very recent evidence since I gave up parapsychology myself, but back in the old days I did study it very carefully, and there were huge problems with it. Not least the fact that everything had to be done through translation. Stevenson himself doesn't speak the various languages in the countries that he went to. He was always working through interpreters. The fact that when they heard he was coming, of course people would rush out. How exciting. Can you imagine? You live in a little village and, you know, miles from any cities in India, and some Western scientists are coming along to talk to you. All the incentive in the world to tell good stories, and these things are very difficult to weed out. I was never impressed by that evidence that it showed reincarnation. But that's an ongoing argument which I've left behind now.
Okay. I mean, we'll follow up with that on the show. I mean, I think there's a number of new case studies that have been generated by local people that still have very good credibility. And credibility is kind of judgmental. But to say the methods seem very appropriate and the people involved seem well-trained and without at least able to keep any bias they have aside, but, you know, that remains to be seen, and we'll just move on. Let's then switch over, and I wanted to play a second clip from Charlie Tart, more on the science, just purely on the science and how much the science changed, and I'm sure you'll have some ideas on that. And then we can switch and talk a few minutes about consciousness, which is much more right to do with your most recent book and your most recent research.
I think what's more likely to happen is that what we call science is going to have to greatly expand its horizons in order to take account things like telepathy, clairvoyance, near-death experiences, and so forth. Now, that's all right with me. To me, science is common sense. Science is saying, observe things as well as you can, and of course you're going to think about them and theorize and explain them away. But fine, look at your experiences. Look at the psychic stuff, too. Don't just look at material things.
And again, that's some material we kind of covered before, but do you have any additional thoughts on that?
Yeah, Charlie speaks so well, and he's absolutely right. Science is going to have to expand dramatically to take account of all kinds of experiences, but not, I would say, telepathy or clairvoyance, because the evidence isn't there to suggest that science needs to expand. You know, I think it was Richard Dawkins who once said, if any scientist discovered really convincing evidence for telepathy and a theory or even the beginnings of a theory that account for it, everybody would rush around them. They'd become famous overnight. They'd probably get a Nobel Prize, and they'd deserve it. And that's true. I mean, the whole science community, if there were such good evidence, would want to know, because it would so dramatically affect our understanding of the universe. That's another reason for not thinking it's not there. But I do go along with Charlie very much in that some of the experiences, near-death experiences, maybe out-of-the-body experiences, but mystical experiences more so, or just ordinary consciousness, is going to have to force an expansion of science. Not an expansion that says, you know, materialism's wrong, you know, something, but something that really forces us to rethink the nature of consciousness. It seems to me that at the moment, most scientists working on consciousness are working in a kind of, they're pretending to be monists, they reject Cartesian dualism, they say they don't believe in a separate mind and body, but they somehow still believe that consciousness is a separate thing created by the brain, and they're looking for how the brain does it. Somehow I think that's the wrong way to go about it, and we need some kind of new paradigm to understand consciousness, but it won't be anything to do with telepathy and clairvoyance, because those old-fashioned ideas are just not the way to go. We really need some new thinking, open our eyes to something new, and I don't yet know what that's going to be.
Very good, and I think that covers a lot of the current state of consciousness. Can you tell us anything more about any discoveries that you had while putting together your book, Conversations on Consciousness, anything that might have affected your views on the topic?
When I was doing the interviews for those books, I asked all the questions that I really personally wanted the answers to. I was thinking of myself more than of the book, really. And I asked all those people, do you have free will? And the answers were fascinating. I had expected that all of them being either scientists or philosophers, they would mostly say, of course, there's no such thing as free will. But they didn't. Most of them either said they did believe in free will, or they said, well, of course, I know there can't be free will in the traditional sense, but I have to live my life as if there is free will. Now, that interested me greatly because I have long ago, even as a teenager, I think, come to the conclusion that as the Buddha did, that the world is causally closed, that everything that happens happens because of what happened before. There's no kind of magic thing to jump in. There's no, you know, little self to kind of magically make the brain work. The brain runs itself. So there can't be free will. So I agonized about this and in the end decided, well, if there isn't any free will, I've got to live that way. I must live accepting that I am a machine that lives its life, that it does things because of the environment it's in, the genes, the memes, the things that happen and so on, and try my hardest to live that way. Now, that sounds extraordinary because you might think, well, how can you try if there's nobody to try? But in a way, I see that as the whole kind of spiritual enterprise, really, to try to live honestly to what we know about our own minds and about brains. So that was a really interesting part of the conversations in the book for me.
You know, I hear what you're saying intellectually and philosophically. It just doesn't jive with, and you say the same thing, it doesn't jive with the experience. It doesn't jive with the experience of being a parent and falling in love with your children and going through all the heartache. It doesn't jive with any kind of experience that I've ever had with meditation or any kind of transcendent experience. And it just seems so lacking and just so in the head.
You've just given the most beautiful example there. You really have, falling in love with your children. Isn't it amazing? You have this screaming baby that anybody else would think, oh, not another. And you adore it. I remember gazing into the cot of my firstborn, you know? And now they're age 24 and 22. And, oh, I love them. You don't expect that, do you, until it happens to you? Well, exactly. You know, we are biological creatures. We're made to be that way. And isn't it wonderful? And if we open our hearts to it, you know, it's an amazing thing to be a parent and have kids. Why are you saying this is incompatible with thinking of ourselves as a biological machine? Because I don't think it is.
Because you just said, open your heart. How would we open our heart if we have no free will, if consciousness is just a biological process that's generated by this hunk of meat up there? It doesn't seem at
all. Why not? Why should it be? If open your heart is a shorthand for take a look, allow the emotions to rise, something like that, which we can describe it in simpler, in sort of straightforward language, something like that. Why should that be harder if you believe that you are a biological machine than if you believe that you have a spirit or a soul inside you? I don't see a reason why that should be harder.
It's not harder per se. It just, again, it requires you to completely dismiss and reinterpret your experience.
Yes, it does. It does, absolutely. It requires you to take a very deep breath, throw out all of those kind of assumptions that you've been brought up with about spirits and souls and transcendence, all those kind of things. Throw them out and go, okay, let's look again with an open mind. That's what it forces you to do. And that is tough. And again, you said to do with experience in meditation. Well, that's another whole fascinating direction. If you sit in meditation and stare into the face of arising phenomena, what do you see? Well, I think many people would agree, after at least some practice, after you learn to calm the mind, see clearly, get enough of the rubbish allows to go away so that there's clarity, and then you ask something like, who's meditating? You find, ooh, I don't know. Or if you ask, who am I? You go find that self. This is one of the fundamental discoveries in meditation. And that seems to me absolutely compatible with what I was saying. It's hard. It's hard to throw out the ordinary sense of self. But no one ever said that the task of meditation was easy.
Right. But of course, there's a completely different interpretation of that. And it's the interpretation that's most commonly gained from Buddhists or people who meditate in the Buddhist tradition. And it's the story of Buddha reaching the transcendent experience and coming back because he's realizing that there's a connectedness and that there is a shared consciousness. Now, your interpretation of that is different. I understand that, but it really goes against thousands of years and thousands and upon millions of lives who have interpreted it a completely different way.
Well, yes and no. I think what happens, and this is something I'm very interested in, I think what happens in the many, many different branches of Buddhism is that the ideas of a self and a soul and spirit and so on and a reincarnation are so deeply embedded in the cultures into which Buddhism spread that they're the starting point and they're what people endlessly want to be true. And they will interpret their Buddhism that way. And although Buddhism itself, or what the Buddha, the Four Noble Truths and the basic teachings of the Buddha are very simple and very stark, you get traditions that build up masses of deities that have to be, prayed to, and all these complicated ideas of visualizations and statues and all sorts of things. All of that gets built up, but at the heart of it are some very simple ideas about the nature of suffering and the nature of no self and non-action, non-doing, not being a self who does anything. And one of my favorite quotations from the Buddha is, actions do exist and also their consequences, but the person that acts does not. I mean, that seems to me to say it all. Here is the universe in which things happen, but there isn't anybody doing anything. Now, my experience of Buddhist practice, I should say I mostly work on my own, but I have done quite a bit of training, mostly in Zen and Chan and some in Mahamudra, but I've come across lots of Buddhist groups, is that when you get to the really good teachers, they're not teaching all the stuff about reincarnation and gods and deities and stuff. They go right to the heart of this stuff, and they inquire into deep questions like, who am I? What is this? What? You know? And that's at the heart of it all.
I think you're probably right. In every culture layers upon the mythology for all sorts of reasons of coherence and everything else. But I think the final comment I guess I'd make on this is there's a completely different interpretation of there is no I, and that's that there is no separateness from all the rest of us, but that we are a collective consciousness. And that would have an entirely different meaning on...
It would. That would be an idea which, you know, in the beginning was where I started out from. That was fundamental to my PhD work. I had this grand theory about all memories being united in a kind of grand psychic space which was accessible to us all, a kind of group consciousness thing. It would be totally different. I have never been able to see a way to make that work. I thought I could back when, you know, in my 20s, I really thought I could make that kind of idea work, and I can't make it work intellectually. I've then been driven into actual practice, you know, really hard work of looking to see how it is, and I don't think it looks like that in the end. I think the oneness is a much more fundamental oneness than that. You see, that idea would have kind of matter, you know, I'm looking out the window and I can see the trees and the houses in the distance. You know, there'd be all that stuff and bodies, and there'd also be this, you know, consciousness that we all are. But I don't think there is that separation. I think there's only this stuff that is both matter and mind, if you like. It's just what there is, which is impenetrable and difficult to understand. That's what we all have in common, not some extra thing called group consciousness. At least that's the way I'm going at the moment. But, you know, hey, I'm just staring into it and trying to find out. But I've rejected a whole lot of those old ideas because they don't work, and I'm really trying to find something better, something that will make sense at all.
Just another seeker. Well, I can definitely relate to that.
Yeah.
Dr. Blackmore, thank you very, very much for joining us. It's been a real pleasure, and thank you for taking the time.
You're very welcome. I've enjoyed it.
If you'd like more information about Dr. Blackmore, you can visit the Skeptico website, that's skeptiko.com, and look for the links that we've provided in our show notes. While you're there, consider dropping me a note. Several of you have, and I really appreciate hearing from you. I also wanted to follow up on one email I received from Jacob at mind-energy.net. He's got a great blog and website there regarding mind energy issues in parapsychology, and he's beginning an online psi experiment that looks very interesting. You might want to check that out. We'll have links to that on the show notes as well. So please continue telling your friends about Skeptico, blog about us, write reviews for us on iTunes, and anything else you feel worthy of promoting the show. Again, thanks for joining us, and bye for now.